Hello, Bill.
Good afternoon, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
The DMZ, back in effect. How is Southern DMZ handling death of the Constitution, democracy, freedom, liberty, and such? Or is it just a nonstop party in West Virginia?
So far, everyone seems super happy. but it is interesting, right? Like, at a certain point, some of the things that Trump and Elon Musk are doing will hit red state America. I saw Katie Britt down in Alabama is upset about some of the cuts to NIH that will disproportionately hit Alabamians, many of whom I think work in the hospital industry, for lack of a better word. So, but so far, West Virginia, we're just focused on baby dogs.
Do you have enough interactions with normal human beings in West Virginia to get a sense of this is awesome, this is everything I ever wanted, you know, go Elon, this is fantastic? Or there's some people saying this is, I mean, I like Trump, but this is not what exactly I signed up for. Do you have any feel?
No. And part of it is, sadly, ever since I left the church I was going to, that cut me off from a lot of my interaction. We've had some, in fact, it's just another snow day here in Southern DMZ. So I'm not out and about as much. But I am having lunch with Mom on Friday, so we'll get some Pennsylvania news. But my gut instinct is everything's honky-dory and even better. Like, not just that they're not upset, but that things are amazing. Because this is a guy who's getting stuff done.
And in the local paper, is there anything about West Virginia losing grants, potentially, that's ruffling feathers?
Haven't seen it. Now, again, you know, local papers being in the state that they are, you know, I don't voraciously consume or get them even, but I've not heard anything, not seen anything. So, no.
Okay. All right.
But,
I mean, as long as people are happy with fascism, then fascism is fine. You know, that's the bottom line.
So, okay, let's put a pin here because I think this sparks a bigger conversation, which is, every couple of days, I think I miss Bill Scheer. We should do a show. I'd love to talk to Bill. And then I'm like, yeah, but then we have to talk about politics. And that's politics right now is super depressing and it's a bummer. Yeah. But it sounds like you really feel like you're not exaggerating. Like, it seems like you've hit rock bottom here with some of this.
I mean, there are probably other humans who are even more bereft than I am. I mean, partly I'm not consuming as much news as I used to. I don't want to live and breathe this hellscape.
Yeah.
So it's not just, it's on the background of my day, the way news used to be. And I'm also, I always try to remind myself that a lot of what Trump does is more talk than action. So I can't assume every utterance means the worst all the time. A lot of what Trump is doing is, I think, ineffectual. The problem is that the things that Elon Musk does are not ineffectual. He's actually a more active character in this than Trump is. In the first term, you know, we didn't really see the White House flatly snub judicial rulings, and Trump lost at the courts a fair amount. It's not like the courts rolled over him. There's stuff that Trump lost. A lot of Trump's attempts at deregulation got smacked down. And now we have I'm not quite saying we are literally in the constitutional crisis because not everything's been fully litigated yet, but you certainly see the vice president encourage snubbing judicial rulings and other people on social media egging Trump and Musk on. We now have one judge saying, you are violating my order, but what happens next is still a little unclear. So, so I wouldn't say I'm quite at rock bottom, pretty close. But as I wrote today, the fact that a independent judiciary still exists so far is something to be relieved about. Be happy that Democrats didn't pack the court, didn't undermine the independent judiciary concept. The basic structure of the Constitution as the founders designed still exists. And we're seeing the value in that right now. And it's at some point, it's going to come to the Supreme Court to prove its worth. And I'm not saying I expect the Supreme Court to do everything that I want to do at every instance, but I retain hope that they're going to do, you know, the bare minimum to make sure that the Constitution remains intact.
So you're saying there's a chance.
I'm saying there's a chance.
Well, okay, so if the you and I both thought it was wrong, that you and I both thought Democrats should not pack the court. We yep. urged them not to do that, and they did not do that. But obviously, if they had done that, then that would have been a permission structure for Trump to do it now. And to break even more norms. But there's really nothing stopping Trump from doing it, right? I mean, technically speaking, he could do it if Republicans went along with it. If he got Republicans to go along with it, he could do it, right?
Well, you'd have to abolish the filibuster first. I mean, to pack the court, you'd have to pass a law adding seats to the Supreme Court and then fill them. And you can't do that with a straight majority as it stands. And if Democrats had done it first, it's not just that Trump could have then, you know, double packed the Supreme Court. They could have passed a law to expand seats up and down the entire judiciary. I mean, right now it's district courts that are issuing the stays. They could have passed law, you know, obliterating all the courts with added seats and filling with lackeys, and then do all the executive orders, and you wouldn't even get the injunctions. It would just be done. That you wouldn't have any sort of judiciary in any meaningful sense at that point. So if Trump was going to take that tack now, you know, he would need to first abolish the filibuster and then pass those kinds of laws. And John Thune and several other Republicans said ahead of time, we're not going to limit the filibuster. Now, could they cave at any point in time? Sure. I mean, if we get to the point where we have willing authoritarians in every branch of government, then yeah, at that point, all is lost. But we're not at that point yet. And it's a good thing that Democrats didn't, you know, assume the worst. I mean, the arguments that were made at the time to pack the court, I wrote about this at the Washington Monthly, essentially were the Republicans effectively packed the court already because they didn't let Obama fill the Scalia seat, and they rammed through Amy Coney Barrett. That was a little bit later in the discussion. I mean, usually earlier on, I was talking about Merrick Garland and how he got blocked. You know, they've already done this, so it's already moot. We don't have an independent judiciary, so you might as well do it. And I think you can see now, you know what? What they did, as bad as that was, it's not the same as outright court packing and completely making it impossible to have an independent judiciary. Because what remains of the judiciary is still functioning and still providing a check on the executive. So it's a reminder to not assume that everything is the literal worst all the time. Usually things can still get worse, and you don't want to throw out the pillars of constitutional democracy because you're in a lather.
And I see you've had some recent praise for Senator Mitch McConnell.
Well, you know, this is just today. I mean, you know, I wouldn't call it praise. You know, praise is probably a little too strong. But we just had the vote today confirming Tulsi Gabbard as the head of, you know, Director of National Intelligence, which is it is absurd. And you know, Matt, that any self-respecting conservative Republican knows that Tulsi Gabbard is, I mean, to call it absurd is probably too charitable. I mean, she is anathema to national security. If a Democrat had proposed Tulsi Gabbard to be director of national intelligence, every Republican would be in full DEFCON 1 mode calling for presidential impeachments. There is nothing about her remotely Republican, remotely conservative in terms of national security. Yeah. Perhaps she's gone, you know, anti-woke in other areas that you might, you know, want to talk about if you're Republican, but not in terms of D&I. And the only Republican to make the intellectually consistent and honest case against her was Mitch McConnell, literally the only person. And you're seeing Republicans roll over themselves on, you know, I mean, Pete Hegseth was only opposed by Collins and Murkowski and McConnell. So we'll see what happens with RFK Jr. if McConnell's going to stick to being principled or roll over the West. But
who was the senator from Louisiana who in the past had been Cassidy? What a disappointment, you know, in the past had been somewhat brave.
So in terms of who is the most reasonable Republican in office in Washington today, I'm left with Mitch McConnell. And I posted it on Blue Sky, and some people would say things like, Mitch McConnell is why we're here. Yeah, I'm not saying this like exonerates the rest of his career. I'm saying things are so bad that someone who was as partisan and unprincipled and as much of a handmaid to Trump and the weakening of the Supreme Court as anybody else, he is still the best we have right now in Washington, D.C.
Yeah,
because at least he has the decency to oppose Tulsi Gabbard. He's the only one.
I think I'm more favorable to Mitch than you are. But his big mistake, I think, was the impeachment vote. Obviously, that's a huge, huge miss. So, Bill, I have to say, I mean, there's some good things happening from my conservative standpoint. The DEI stuff Trump's done, I'm broadly in favor of. Trans athletes, I'm broadly in favor of his position there. Getting tough with Hamas, we'll see how that goes with the Saturday deadline. But, you know, I like the way he's talking. We'll see if he backs it up. We got a hostage back from Russia. So maybe there's some good things that'll happen. I'd love it if they could take out Iran's nuclear capabilities. Working with Israel seems within the realm of possibility. But in terms of this other stuff that you're lamenting, the constitutional stuff, I am completely in agreement with you, Bill. But I have to say, I think just like you and I, this is not new. Like I'm back in November when the election happened is when I kind of mourned. At that point, I felt like the die was cast. The American public has decided to go this direction. And I'm still grappling with it and dealing with it. But I'm not really surprised by anything, actually. I've been like, this is what you get. Trump told us who he was. And, you know, that's what we got.
Even with the things like DEI and transgender participation in sports and things of that nature, are you at all unnerved at how Trump is going about this? Are you still unnerved that he is not following the law in how he is trying to affect policy, and therefore it bothers you about the basic nature of checks and balances, even when he is doing it in the service of a position you agree with?
I would just say, generally speaking, I think that process matters. And so even if you're doing something that is on the merits good, you have to follow the rule of law. I haven't really seen anything specifically in regards to those issues that concern me. But yeah, you gotta do it the appropriate way and the right way. And then just in terms of anything that's lasting, like executive orders are also flimsy by definition. I mean, you're not really winning the argument, and you're not even winning the vote, let alone the argument necessarily, when you do them. So there's always that. But, you know, I knew that, of course, as a conservative, there are going to be some things that Trump does that I will agree with and like. But at what cost? I mean, if we, win on a given issue that I like, but lose freedom, then that's cold comfort.
Now, how do you think, Matt? I mean, you know that there are lots of conservatives over the past 30 years that call themselves constitutional conservatives. The Constitution is paramount. We must respect the founders' wisdom. We must root, you know, judicial opinions in originalism. And when Barack Obama or Joe Biden issued executive orders, immediately the response was, this is unconstitutional. They're eroding precedents. They're asserting power that they don't have. Do you have any sense that there are conservatives in Washington today, or at least privately saying, letting Elon Musk simply stop payments and freeze spending that Congress voted to appropriate, just completely obliterates any sense of constitutional checks and balances and rule of law, and violates all the stuff that we used to say in opposing the use of executive orders? Is there anyone quietly saying, you know, Matt, I know I can't say this publicly, but this really kind of, you know, burns my muffins?
Well, no one's saying that to me anymore, and it's because this has been going on for a decade now. So the people who used to come to me and say, hey, Matt, between you and me, like, we're not friends anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know what I mean? So I don't really have an interaction with them, but I'm confident that what you've just described, there are people who are among the Never Trumpers, who are conservatives, who obviously believe that what is happening now is unconstitutional and certainly flies in the face of all the tri-cornered hats that we saw at CPAC over the years. And it's obvious that I would say that the vast majority of you, of Republican senators, privately do feel this way as well. But if there was a referendum tomorrow on what Elon's doing, maybe Mitch McConnell would vote against it, right? Everyone else would vote for it. So it really is a distinction without much of a difference.
Now, at some point, Republicans in Congress will have to vote on things. Right now, they're getting a free ride. Let Elon Musk do it. Let him do all the dirty work. We don't have to vote on the cuts.
Let someone else do it.
Right. But they have to pass, or I mean, I think they're going to try to pass a budget resolution. You could not pass one. You could just go to the appropriations bills. But if you want to pass a reconciliation bill, you have to, I believe you have to do that within the budget resolution process. If I remember my parliamentary procedure properly. Even if it's the shell of a thing, you have to do it. And they will have to keep the government open past March 14th. So that will require passing, you know, if not individual appropriations bill, some kind of continuing resolution. And they have to raise the debt limit at some point this year. So they actually have to take some votes. To that middle one, keeping the government open, will actually require hard numbers on spending levels. And it seems like they don't quite have their act together on those things. You know, at what point does it become hard for Republicans just to simply be Trump lackeys? At some point, do they have to express their own opinions about things? Because Trump can't babysit them and Elon Musk can't babysit them the entire 4 years.
Yeah. And look, I mean, I heard AOC the other day saying, like, we shouldn't bail Republicans out. I mean, Republicans only have a couple seat majority in the House. And so I think it's plausible that we do end up shutting the government down for an extended period. And I don't know that Republicans can get enough votes to actually get that done without Democrats, you know, without some Democrats supporting it. So what do you think of that?
And that's a big challenge for Democrats too. I mean, there's an ongoing debate amongst Democrats, yeah. You know, is this full resistance? You get no votes for us on anything, no matter what. Or are you trying to stop damage by trying to negotiate, be able to keep the government open that tries to restore rule of law? Or do you have to say, look, we are the minority here. We can't expect to get everything that we want, but we don't want the government to shut down. We certainly don't want the debt limit to be fail to raise the debt limit and have a default. We got to be, you know, adults
another
here
squeeze,
and
right?
do the bare minimum. I think how far they go to cooperate is very much an uncertainty. And I think it's hard to, it's easy to say something simple, just don't do it, you know, but if it's, then it becomes your fault that the entire global economy melts down because you didn't raise that limit. And that's not such an easy political choice to make.
No, totally. I think they're squeezed. If Democrats go along, like they have very few, pressure points, right? There are very few opportunities that Democrats have to actually make a stink and stop something and force Republicans to like own whatever it is. And so like if Democrats go along with it, then they're just rubber stamping everything and they're sort of complicit. But if Democrats are like stopping government from functioning or creating some sort of an economic meltdown, then like obviously A, it's immoral. You're sort of elected to do things for your constituents. But also it's surrendering like whatever high ground they might have is like, you know, right now they could say like Trump and Elon, they're the ones who are cutting services. They're the ones who are cutting research and development. And, you know, if something bad happens, if there's a hurricane and they've gutted FEMA, if there's another, you know, outbreak and they've gutted the NIH, whatever, you can blame Republicans. Well, guess what? If Democrats are shutting down the government, then they are owning part of that, right? And so it's like damned if you do, damned if you don't, catch 22.
I might write about this later this week. I haven't decided. I'm still trying to collect my own thoughts. But one concept I was kind of mulling on today, it relates to this Katie Britt thing where she's trying to save NIH funding for her state. And, you know, cause I think Democrats, you know, they can't be the party of shutdown. They shouldn't be the party of shutdown. And I've always argued shutdowns are political losers, and Republicans have always been the ones that have agitated for it when they've been in power and when they've been out of power. They've always been the movers on shutdown. And I think it's always worked out badly for them. So I think it'd be a bad move for Democrats to be perceived as relishing shutdown and encouraging shutdown. And that's true, you know, a thousandfold when it comes to the debt limit. So the debt limit's kind of easy. Debt limit, I think Democrats should say, we should raise the debt limit, put a bill on the floor that raises the debt limit and does nothing else, and we will vote for that. You tack on irrelevant stuff that's part of your ideological project, then that's on your shoulders to deal with, not ours. I think that's pretty simple. When it comes to keeping the government open, which involves spending levels, Republicans want to cut things, and they're in the majority. So it's a hard place for Democrats to say, well, you have to cut absolutely nothing to get our votes, because that's gonna be a non-starter. And Republicans could say Democrats want to shut down the government because they don't want to cut any spending, and that's not like that's a tough political place for them to be in. What I think they could do, and grant there's a huge complication here that Chris Murphy has articulated, which is, how are we supposed to negotiate with you guys when you have a president that's totally disregarding what Congress says about spending? If the president is going to treat this as irrelevant, then why should we be a part of this whatsoever? You know, so I think it's fair for Democrats to say, you got to put something in this bill that puts us all on record saying you're not allowed to impound. You have to adhere to the 1974 law in this regard. If you violate it, that we as a body are going to sue. These might be bridges too far for Republicans, I grant, but I think it's reasonable for Democrats to say this is an illegitimate process if your president's not going to totally treat this as toilet paper. So there's that complication. But putting that aside, I like to think there's a way that Democrats could say, look, I understand you want to cut things. You ran on cutting things. You're in the majority. I'm not going to like it, but I understand something's going to be cut. But if you want us to cooperate with you, then those cuts have to be evenly distributed across the country. You can't have a deal where the president has the leeway to do all the cuts in the blue states and give all the money to the red states. We cannot be a party to that. Mm-hmm. If you mean what you say about cutting, then it applies across the board. It's not just picking winners and losers about which constituents are on your team.
Except Alabama. Bill, let me ask you this. I've got two things and then we can maybe hit the road. But this question, I think, will gauge just how depressed you are. So I think there's a scenario where Donald Trump and Elon Musk do all this stuff. And then, you know, right now they're running this hurry up offense. They're like a football game starts. You've scripted the first 15 plays. Mm-hmm. You're running this hurry up offense. You're putting points on the board. At a certain point, you know, you're out of breath. The other team starts catching up. You're under pressure. And you run out of gas, basically. Will this catch up to Republicans? You know, will they get blamed when the next Katrina happens or the next terrorist attack or whatever it is and suffer in the midterms and end up losing the presidency because Trump is misreading his mandate, like almost every president does? They think that they've got this mandate. And then you could make an argument, look, Trump might be magic, but J.D. Vance isn't magic. J.D. Vance doesn't have the charisma that Donald Trump has. So is there a way of looking at this and saying, hey, ride it out. It's going to be rough, but Republicans are digging their own grave right now. Or is Trump really rolling over our institutions and rejiggering things in a way that will make it pretty much impossible to unwind and possibly mean that he never leaves the White House again?
Well, yeah, so long as... Just to get to that last point, you know, we have 50 secretaries of state. They're not going to just put Trump on the ballot for a third term, which is unconstitutional. You might have a couple of like conspiratorial Trump lackeys in that mix. But by and large, even most of the Republican secretaries of state are above board secretaries of state. They're just not going to do that. Could the Supreme Court say, you know what, this 22nd Amendment, there's another way to read that that says Trump could actually be on the ballot, and I'm going to read it that way and say that he can. I mean, if you have five Supreme Court justices, they're going to be handmaidens to fascism, then all is lost.
Call me naive, but I think Amy Coney Barrett, whom I've long been a fan of, I don't think she does that.
I agree with that. And Roberts would. I don't think Roberts would do that. So there's five. So
I think Alito and Thomas would, but I think the other three Republicans probably wouldn't. So in that regard, as long as they don't pack the court,
right. So I don't think Trump runs a third term. But to the larger question you were asking, I don't believe that Trump has any interest in effective governance, and I don't think he has surrounded himself with people that care about effective governance. They care about putting points on the board. So they had Project 2025, which we all can see now was always the plan, no matter how much Trump wanted to deny it.
Come on, dude. We knew it was always the plan. Right. Anybody who believed – and I wrote a column at The Hill saying – congratulations, everyone. This is what you voted for. Trump told us who he was. He said he was going to do vengeance. He said he was going to do retribution. He said he was going to do tariffs, whatever. And some people pushed back and said, yeah, but he said that he wasn't really going to do Project 2025. And to which I say, okay, you got me on that one. But you knew he was lying. Everyone knew.
I mean, it's always possible he was going to sort of pick and choose what he wanted from it, and he wasn't going to do literally every last thing. But clearly what has happened is he let all the inmates into the asylum, out of the asylum, to just exactly do whatever they wanted to do. I mean, to the extent that he's micromanaging it all, I doubt. But everyone just took all that Project 20 Project stuff and wrote up the executive orders, put it on his desk, and he signed them. So they were prepared to do stuff. Are they prepared to do the stuff in a way that actually benefits regular Americans because they actually care about the nuts and bolts of governing? I see zero evidence of that. The obsession with tariffs is first and foremost. I would think at this point, people who want to be president or work in a presidential administration would know there are a few things you just don't want to screw up. You don't want a terrorist attack. You don't want a colossal public health crisis. You don't want to screw up a natural disaster, and you don't want inflation. Like if you do those things,
yeah,
you're probably going to stay in power for a long time. If you cared about executing, you would say, I'll put crazy people all sorts of places, but for counterterrorism and for health and human services and for treasury, mm-hmm, and trade, I'm going to make sure I got some sober people there so I don't screw up the basics. Then I can do whatever the hell I want all these other areas. That's not how Trump operates. Yeah. He's put total, is it Joe Kent? This guy was like literally a white nationalist. It's like heading up counterterrorism. That's bonkers stuff. And maybe you get lucky. Maybe you get lucky and the economy works out on its own. And, we don't get hit by a terrorist attack. And maybe being a giant jackass about tariffs, everyone cowers to you and they bend and they lower their rates somehow. So this is all theoretically possible that all stars align, mm-hmm, for Trump. But I went through one Trump administration and it didn't go that way. It ended really, really badly, not just for him, but for the rest of us, where literally a million people died. Yeah. If I was a Republican, I would be terrified that I was tying up my future to a guy who has zero interest in doing the basics correctly.
Valid point. It does seem, again, poised that something will go wrong and they will get blamed. Although they're good at deflecting blame, they might blame Joe Biden.
It's so much harder to deflect blame when you are literally the president.
Yeah.
I've heard this before because there's all sorts of blame shifting has happened in the past month over the course of the presidential campaign. But when he was president and there was a colossal pandemic, he was not able to deflect blame.
Yeah.
So I don't believe it's going to be
easy. You've been there for 3 years. Look, I do think... part of what's interesting about this, too, is that there's at least three different things, right? You've got Donald Trump, where there's chaos and incompetence and capriciousness, but also he's got some good political instincts about things. Like, he doesn't want to tackle, entitlement. I think we should, but it's unpopular. He gets that, right?
They might now.
Well, that brings me to that's part of my point. But then, so one strain is Trump. But then you've got conservative ideologues who really hate the government. They literally, Grover Norquist talks about drowning it. He wants to get government so small we could literally drown it in a bathtub, right? Mm-hmm. And they are very dogmatic about destroying government. I've always been a conservative. I've never really cared that much about. I want limited government, but I've never kind of hated government. But some of these people have a real just hatred of government in general. And then you've got, this brings me to my next point, the Elon Musk Silicon Valley move quick and destroy things or whatever the motto is. And that's a different animal. And I wanted to bring this point up, Bill. And this is a theory, but I think it's interesting, right? So you've got Elon Musk, who is like apparently on ketamine and psychedelics and stuff. I believe that a lot of the influencers on the right today are on drugs or have been on drugs. And like the MyPillow guy was like a cocaine addict, crack addict or something. That does stuff that changes your brain. Meanwhile, this is interesting. You think about it, what has happened in 2012, we had Mitt Romney as the nominee. In 2016, we got Donald Trump. What in the hell happened to America, right? In those 4 years? Well, Barack Obama's presidency, obviously, you know, him getting reelected in 2012, I think radicalized people. You had the Obergefell decision, the gay marriage decision happened around then, probably underrated in terms of its impact. You've had social media, more and more people getting, since 2012, getting smartphones and getting on social media. But here's one. In 2012 is when we started recreational legal marijuana. And I wonder, this is the theory, I wonder to what degree today's like weird conspiratorial electorate, right? It's not just Elon Musk. It's the electorate, the people voting. I wonder to what degree the sort of conspiratorial thinking is a product of a blitzed nation. What do you think, Bill?
I mean, I attribute that more to the rise of social media than drug use. I mean, there's plenty of drug use before that didn't lead to.
Not from like grandmas and grandpas and normies.
I mean, sure, you have a certain, there's more cultural permissiveness around cannabis because of the legalization initiatives in many states. But I don't know if I can, how easily I can draw a line between that and conspiratorial thinking. I do see more clearly see the fracturing of the media landscape to make it a lot easier for people to inject conspiratorial notions in social media.
That's for sure.
And have people, and you see how people self-select the media that they consume. And I think the pandemic, pandemic has made us stupider than. And Matt, you know, I'm not a drug user, so I'm not trying to be,
Look, I want to be clear. I am not. This is not a single causal or whatever the word is. Like, I'm not saying that this is the reason. Mm-hmm. I just think it's curious how we went from Mitt Romney mm-hmm. to Donald Trump mm-hmm. in 4 years, and I suspect mm-hmm. it's a confluence mm-hmm. of events. That are,
but even beyond that period, post-pandemic, I feel that because I mean there was sort of an article of faith amongst people on the left that if a bad thing happens, then it'll be easier to show people the connection between good policy and good outcomes. If we have a oil spill in the Gulf, people will more easily see how important it is to have renewable energy and combat climate change. And so some of these arguments were always, a stretch. But in some cases, you could say, hey, we had a colossal financial meltdown in 2008 after a period of widespread financial deregulation. Maybe we should have financial re-regulation so we don't have that happen again. Like there are times when you are able to connect the dots. And in the pandemic, instead of people saying, wow, I guess it's really important to have good public health information and to follow science to make sure that we can contain these things and so not have it kill a million people. You had so many grifters put forth the most ludicrous theories, anything that could essentially validate you not having to change your life in any way. You're mad because you had to change your day-to-day life for a period of time, or someone asked you to do so, whether it is staying inside or wearing a mask or whatever, and that got you upset. And someone's telling me, oh, I didn't have to do that? And it's because some weirdo mm-hmm. conspiracy of pizza-owning pedophiles was forcing toxic vaccines into me? That's why that happened? That's now, I can find that very much more easily online. And I can choose to believe that and not believe the more professional fact checks that are going on. That to me is the biggest breakdown of the social cohesion that we've had since the pandemic, which makes rationality so much more difficult to articulate.
Well, and then, of course, the social distancing, which I think may have been a smart move, a smart idea in terms of stopping the spread, but it creates isolation and loneliness, and that feeds on this problem. I should have also mentioned, Bill, the opioid epidemic and the fentanyl poisoning, which my wife, of course, has a podcast called The Poisoning, which I want to plug. But that also, you know, we were already having problems in middle America, places like West Virginia, where I live. With manufacturing and I think that was just a kick in the face.
But if we're operating in a rational world where people in power actually wanted to solve the problem, actually cared about articulating a policy that would produce a measurable outcome to then run on, you would look more closely at how fentanyl enters the country. And develop policies based on containing that, let alone things you might do to deal with fentanyl production, you know, domestically. Instead, you have Donald Trump, who realizes it's an issue, realizes that people are upset about fentanyl, but has a policy that he likes for whatever reason, which is tariffs. And so I'm going to impose tariffs on you to punish you for not containing fentanyl. But I'm Canada, and I don't actually bring a lot of fentanyl into your country. So what does that do with anything? That doesn't matter. And the fact that it's not going to have any measurable benefit on containing fentanyl importation doesn't matter. It's about showing action, showing strength, quote unquote, being in the news cycle, the next 24/7 news cycle. It's not about actually being able to show the public after a 4-year period, I actually got the amount of fentanyl reduced in the country.
Indeed. And I have to tell you, man, not to go too much into fentanyl, but it seems likely that worse drugs or even more deadly drugs than fentanyl are coming, and they will not, you won't be saved from Narcan if that happens. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I hope it doesn't happen. But and as you probably know, actually, there's been a reduction in deaths in the past year for a variety of reasons, partly, I think, having to do with the availability of Narcan. But something to keep an eye on. Bill, I was hoping that I'd be cheered up and we'd rekindle the fun magic that we used to have. But I feel like this was also super depressing.
Yeah, I'm not going to be a great source of rejuvenation, I think.
I'm not blaming you.
But if like, I want to call Bill Scherer. He always makes me feel better. Like, I don't think that's going to work.
Well, you used to have a podcast called Talk Me Down.
I did.
Now I need to talk you down.
Okay, I'm probably not the biggest doomsdayer out there, but I can't be a phony source of optimism when things are genuinely bad.
I feel you, man. All right. Anything you want to plug?
Well, check out my most recent article at the Washington Monthly. It's good that Democrats did not pack the courts. And I'm very active on, or was relatively active on, Blue Sky these days. Whatever my weirdo Blue Sky handle is, billshared.bsky.social. And the Washington Monthly is up there as well at washingtonmonthly.com, on Blue Sky, as well as other social media platforms. That's where I'm at.
Sweet. I am also on Blue Sky, mattklewis.whatever.com.
How's Blue Sky for you as a non-liberal?
You know what? I like Blue Sky, but I still spend more time on X just because I've got so many more followers on X. And I was hoping that I would join Blue Sky and I could just transition over and be there most of the time, but just doesn't work out that way for me. I'm just, for whatever reason, much more popular on X. So,
well,
maybe
I think
you can change
that. I like Blue Sky, and I'm barely on X anymore. Well, I haven't deleted my account, but Blue Sky is pretty heavy with you know progressives.
Yeah,
and so I mean, I will still be contrarian sometimes on Blue Sky. It's like I'm stopping, not censoring myself, but I can see if I just do a simple post that criticizes Trump, that's got a good chance of getting, you know, traction. And I just imagine that if you're being still kind of conservative, if never Trumpy, that may not, you may not get great engagement on Blue Sky the way you might still get on X. That might be a disincentive for you.
Now, it might be.
I want you on Blue Sky, but I'm just trying to be candid.
Nope. I feel you. Okay. Well, I'm there. So, but yeah. Maybe someday they'll invent a social media platform for me, for guys like me. until then, the DMZ is not yet on Blue Sky that I know of, but we are on Twitter at DMZ Show. Follow us there. And Bill, always a pleasure, even during dark times, my friend.
If you need to escape, you know, the People's Republic of Massachusetts is here for you.
I was in Boston. I gave a speech in Boston last week, believe it or not. My first time ever. And I was just, it was in and out very quick.
Yeah.
But Logan Airport, getting it done, man. I was impressed.
Well,
I was impressed.
Anyway, and if you want a great airport, you go to Bradley, Hartford, Springfield.
Well, I really want to get up there and go to I drove past Fenway Park. But I want to go to a real Red Sox game one day. So we'll get there.
All right.
Sure we will. Sure we will, Mr. Homer. All right, my friend. Have a good one.
Take care.